For those of you who are participants or volunteers, you can attend the evening shows tonight with John Oswald in this venue, tomorrow night with Nicole Mitchell, not in this venue, but nearby, at a discount of $3, and tickets will be available at the door. Ticket prices are not that expensive. It's Swami Ted Popo, so it's for the people, and therefore not meant to be like the other, perhaps the other festival that's well known in Montreal in a few weeks. There will be, in addition to keynote sessions, there will be parallel sessions. The other venue is downstairs, the dining room just downstairs. It was to your left as you came in. I would ask you, for the sake of efficiency, to try to make your decision relatively quickly while you're having coffee, to go upstairs or downstairs, so that we can move quickly as between sessions. I will ask chairs to try to be ruthless and gentle at the same time, but particularly ruthless in terms of time, and keeping the whole thing on time. Again, because at the end of the day, we've got to take all the chairs down and prepare this room for the concert in the evening. For those of you who are participants or volunteers, lunch and dinner is provided today and tomorrow, and that will be in another room in the sala, I think the one just off to the right as you came in. I'm going to remind you all about that. I think that's it for nuts and bolts. I should thank our primary sponsor, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the Centre for Intellectual Property Policy at McGill, and in particular Helene Hamou, who did organizational work, the Dean of the Faculty of Law at McGill, who support us, Sala Rosa and the Suoni del Popolo Music Festival, one of the major collaborators in the larger project. And one of the distinctive hallmarks of the larger project is the degree of social contact, social involvement of community groups in Montreal, in Guelph, in Vancouver. Each of the conferences being run as part of the larger project is attached to a music festival. And there are a number of other different social groups, community groups working with adolescents, for example, and other organisms, who are helping us understand improvisation as part of their daily routines. I'd like to thank the volunteers who were out bright and early this morning, who will be out bright and early tomorrow morning. And finally, I want to thank Poku Atsai, who I can see in the room, who has effortlessly, seamlessly done a great deal of organizational work. You all received emails from Poku, I'm sure, in terms of the organization of this conference. So, thanking him in his absence. Without further ado, I'll turn the mic over to Eric Lewis, who is the McGill head of the larger project.
Perhaps you mentioned this, and I missed it in my sleepy haze, but also for conference participants, there's a free catered lunch and dinner.
You
did, okay, great. Yes, sleep deprivation's already set in. I'm really pleased to see all of you here and some return customers from last year. I mean, the project, which is just entering its third year, is really starting to sort of develop a groundswell of community scholars and participants who are turning up a lot of our events. And for those who are in the area, there'll be our next conferences in Guelph in September in association with the Guelph Jazz Festival, and hope to see some of you there. It really gives me great pleasure to introduce Keith Sawyer, our first keynote of this conference, from Washington University in St. Louis in the Department of Faculty of Education. Keith's work in creativity, innovation, improvisation, and play really constitute some of the foundational texts that inform improvisational studies more broadly as they now are unfolding. He works in everything from children's play, to improvisation in musical context, to the role of creativity and improvisation in management structures and other sorts of social structures. He has, usually at this point, one might mention the major publications of the person you're introducing, but we would run out of time. He wouldn't actually be able to speak. He's actually authored or co-authored 10 books in the last 10 years, which raises just one question, why so lazy? His most recent book is Group Genius, The Creative Power of Collaboration, and I'm sure the next book will be penned by this afternoon is my guess. So it just gives me great pleasure to introduce Keith for our first keynote.
Looking out, and I see I've met many of you, but I haven't met all of you. But I assume you're all there because you care about improvisation. Yes?
Yes.
Right? You believe in improvisation as a metaphor, something bigger than improvisation. I mean, one thing that I found fascinating, I started studying improvisation in graduate school in the early 1990s, and it seems to bring together a broad range of interdisciplinary perspectives. My own training is as a psychologist, and I have an appointment in the Department of Education. So I study the psychology of creativity, and I guess I start with a disclaimer that I really know nothing about law, and I know nothing about social policy. So in my talk, I'm going to try to lay out some stories and some examples that might serve as reference points as we go through the next 2 days to think about what does it mean to be improvisation, what principles can we extract from these examples of improvisation. So I'm going to give you some from jazz, some from theater, and then some from the broader sphere of innovation, because that's my title, social innovation. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Not the microphone? Okay, good. It's intimate. Smaller group than most of my college class. So starting out, what is improvisation? One reason I really like improvisation, when I started studying the psychology of creativity, I found that, for the most part, the discipline of psychology approached creativity studies in a way that did not recognize the unique nature of improvisation. Psychologists who studied creativity tended to focus on highly valorized forms of creativity in the West. So they would study symphonic music composition. They would study fine novels, right? Not popular novels, but great fiction. They would study Nobel Prize winning scientists who would generate, you know, important theories. And all of these types of creativity, I realized that what they had in common was that they generated a product. I call them product creativity. And I was interested in improvisational creativity, where they're really, I mean, maybe you record a performance and maybe there's an album. You could think of that as a product, but that's not really the purpose, right? That's not the driving spirit of improvisation. So there's something different between product creativity and improvisational creativity. And I think about a contrast between, I love classical European music tradition, so I'm not beating up on this example just as a foil. This is a symphonic orchestra, and this type of creativity fits pretty well with the psychological model of how creativity works. So what happens with symphonic classical music tradition? I know I'm stereotyping a bit here, but you start with a composer. Anyone recognize this composer? Okay. I knew some. You guys are educated, so you're going to know this. Brahms. So you start with a composer. Brahms, a classic, brilliant, genius kind of individual, has this sort of crazed look in his eye, and most of his photos staring off at the horizon. You know, romantic ideal of the composer, right? What happens is the composer then generates a score representing the composer's creative vision. Then you have some conductor who is responsible for identifying and interpreting the composer's vision as represented in the score. Finally, you have the musicians who execute the vision of the composer as interpreted through the conductor. Now, this fits with a model of creativity that I think a lot of people in our culture have, and I call it a linear model of creativity. And it's linear because it starts with an idea, one person having an idea, and then you have some other person or some group of people selecting the best ideas, because there's way too many ideas and they're not all going to be good, right? There were lots of composers in the 19th century that no one listens to anymore, 18th century. Lots of composers whose works don't even survive, because they weren't good enough for anyone to save the scores, right? So there's a whole process of selection that goes on. And then there's the execution of the work. So we see the composer generating the vision, the score. Those musicians at the bottom right of the last picture, they're the executors, but they're not really the creators, right? You know, they do some sort of creativity in terms of interpreting their, on their instruments, but not really, right? I mean, you know, if you talk to composers and conductors, well, not really, we don't really want them to do that. We want them to do what we're telling them. So it's this notion of creativity being very linear and emerging from the mind of a creative individual. That works reasonably well for product creativity, you could argue. I've actually argued that it doesn't always work so well for product creativity either, but it plausibly works for product creativity. But it doesn't work for improvisational creativity. And honestly, it doesn't work for a lot of social action. That's why I think improvisation is a better model for creativity and social life than other forms of creativity. So I'll give you an example here. We've got to start with some music at a conference like this. So I'm going to play a clip here of a classic jazz performance. Many of you have probably heard this or heard similar performance before. So audio, please. Oh, Steve. I'm ready for the audio.
Of those performances are, well, of course, each musician has
creativity. And that's a solo, and maybe psychologists could study what goes on in the mind of an individual musician. But that's not all that's going on. If you're thinking about a psychologist studying the creativity of classical music, you probably want to focus on Brahms, what's going on in Brahms' mind. And maybe the individual musicians, yeah, we need to know something about, you know, how they make split-second decisions and slow down together. But really, it's about Brahms. But here, you need to know about the creativity of all of the musicians. And you need to know about the role of the song form, right? The chord sheet. How does that guide the improvisations? What is retained from these prior performances? How is that represented? Is that even a psychological question? Maybe that's a sort of oral history, sociological question. Also with the role of shared tradition. And the key thing that I focus on in my research is the final point, the musical interaction among the musicians is absolutely critical. That's the genre of jazz. That's what makes it great, is that when musicians play together, something emerges from this musical communication, this interaction among the musicians. So instead of a linear model of creativity, and this is kind of a hokey picture because I like boxes and arrows, but the I's represent the idea, the S represents the selection, and the D represents the development or execution of an idea. So it's not linear, right? All the musicians are having ideas. They're throwing them out there in the performance. The other musicians are collectively selecting the musical ideas which seem good and which will be developed. And all of the musicians together are developing or executing the ideas. And it's all happening in parallel in a big, messy, complex system. So it's not linear. It's a kind of, I don't know, systemic creativity. And what's going on is, I think, a shift from, to understand this, you need to shift from a psychological, narrow perspective on what's going on in the mind of the creator to what's going on in the group. That's why I call my book Group Genius. So it's really not about the mind of the individual creator. And in my own research, to study these things, I've focused on these super creative groups, like the jazz ensembles, the one you just saw. I've also spent a lot of time studying improvisational theater. Probably most of my career studying improvisational theater, because my own methodologies are interaction analysis. I'm not a musicologist, so I don't have the techniques to transcribe an improvisational music performance. The work of Ingrid Monson, Paul Berliner, they've done great things along those lines. So if I were going to do it, but you know, they're doing it already. So I try to take that sort of approach and apply it to improvised verbal performance. So I spent a lot of time in Chicago studying Chicago Improvisational Theater. This is one of the groups at a theater that I studied called I.O. Theater, one of many theaters in Chicago. It's my favorite one. If you go to Chicago, I highly recommend the I.O. Theater. It used to be called the Improv Olympic. So, but they got sued by the International Olympic Committee, which is very aggressive at protecting their trademark. So it's now I.O. Theater, but they're great. And what makes them unique, you think about other forms of improvisation that you might have seen, a lot of improvisation, comedy sports, there's a television show called Whose Line Is It Anyway, is very short bits, sketch comedy, and you want the audience to laugh, so you're going for a sort of a punchline kind of experience. But these groups would go for what is called long-form improvisation, long-form meaning 30 to 60 minutes, fully improvised play, and nothing is determined in advance. It's even less structured than a jazz performance, because whereas in a jazz performance you have a chord sheet that has the overall 32-bar song form, 16-bar song form, all the musicians know what's going on and they're playing it together. With these improv theater performances, they might do that, right? They might create a series of events that are supposed to happen. They might decide ahead of time which characters each of the actors are going to enact. They might say, in about the 5th minute, something like this is going to happen. In the 15th minute, you know, this character is going to walk on, but all the dialogue will be improvised. But we know basically what's going to happen, the form or the structure. They might do that, but they don't. In fact, they don't decide anything ahead of time. It's completely unknown by the actors what will unfold in the performance. So as opposed to a commedia dell'arte style, where you have a scenario play, which is repeated over and over again, it's different every time with these long-form ensembles. And it actually works so well that when you go see one of these performances for the first time, you might assume they had structured a lot of it ahead of time. But they don't know anything, right? When they get up there on stage, they don't know what genre, they don't know what location, they don't know which types of characters the actors are going to perform. They don't know what plot events are going to occur. So, and as a matter of fact, after 10 minutes of improvising, they don't know what will be the case after 20 minutes. They can't look ahead, right? Because it's unpredictable, it's emerging from the interaction among the actors. And that's fascinating to me, right? That's where I wanted to focus my career, is thinking about this, right? What is it that allows these actors to come together and generate something collectively when no one's in control, right? No one's in charge, no one's guiding the performance, and no one knows where it will go. It's unpredictable. So I have identified a couple of principles that I associated with this type of improvisation when it's effective. You know, it's not good every night, right? And some ensembles have less talented improvisers, or they haven't gelled together as well as others. So what makes it good? Just a quick list, and you, some of you who've improvised, you can probably add to this list. Close listening, everyone's listening very deeply to the other performers. Be really, really listening, or what you know, sometimes called deep listening, which requires you, in a sense, to get out of your own mind, stop thinking about what you're performing and what you think you might do next, and truly listen to what the other performers are doing. There's a form of complete concentration where all of the performers are focused on the performance. Right? So your mind's not distracted, you're not thinking about something else, but you're completely focused, you're in the moment. I think this is true of jazz and improvisational theater. There's a kind of blending of egos that goes on, where if any one individual is thinking too much about themselves, or how do I look, or how is my performance coming, is there an A&R guy in the audience from some recording company? I want to really impress him, so he'll sign me. Those sorts of ego considerations really tend to block the emergence of an effective improvisation. There's an egalitarianism, certainly in improvisational theater, probably even more so than in jazz, because with improv theater, there's never a soloist, right? Whereas in jazz, the tradition is you take turns soloing. But even when one person's soloing, the other musicians are still contributing, right? And they're not just following the soloist. The soloist is not in charge or in control. It really helps if the performers are familiar with each other, right? If you're performing together for the first time, it's probably not going to be a significant, excellent performance. It might be professional, it might be good, but you need some familiarity with the other performers to get to this zone of effective performance. There's got to be some risk, and I think this is part of what drives the excitement of performing this kind of genre, is that you don't know what's going to happen. And that's exciting. I mean, it's tense, right? It could produce anxiety, but if your skill level is up to the challenge, then when you're being challenged at a level that pushes your envelope, that's exciting, right? That gets you in a peak experience flow state. And there's a way that these performers can keep it moving forward, so that whatever one performer does, you get the deep listening, you get the equal participation, you think outside of your own mind, and you build on what the other people do. So as a result of that, our performance is constantly moving forward and it's accumulating over time. It's emerging, right? It's emerging from the bottom up with no guidance and with no one knowing where it's going to go. So I've been talking about these improvisational grooves, but now I want to tell a story about a broader social innovation. I changed gears a little bit. And then I'm going to tie this back to group improvisation. And as I'm telling the story, maybe you can be thinking as well, how is this story like jazz or like improvisation theater? Because it's a really different example. And it's an example of the world's best-selling board game. And this is Monopoly. Monopoly played in Canada? Okay, I mean, it's the world's best-selling board game, so I assume there's
a Montreal edition now.
Yeah. There's a Montreal edition, okay. Yeah.
The French edition.
Right, or there's probably a Quebec edition. Probably a McGill University edition. Is there a McGillopoly?
It's called McGill.
It's life science.
Actually, I was in a gift shop the other day and I saw a Make Your Own Opoly, which had a whiteboard and you could write it all. But I'm going to tell you the story about how Monopoly was created. And you can help me tie it back to improvisation. So when Monopoly came out, it was 1934, and it was was known as the Great Depression, which we're hearing a lot about again now, particularly in the United States. When people say the worst recession in 75 years, you count back to about 1934. So 1934 is when Monopoly was released by Parker Brothers. It's not an auspicious time to release an unnecessary discretionary item. They were charging what was then a high price, $7.50. But it started selling really well, and it was released in January. By April, they had sold 200,000 copies, which was pretty phenomenal for a game at that time. And it was starting to get a lot of press. The media, what's this phenomenon, this game? You know, everybody's buying it, everybody's playing it. By the end of 1934, they had sold 1 million copies. So this was just a phenomenal success. I mean, no board game has ever done anything like this before 1934. Parker Brothers had been on the verge of bankruptcy. The game saved their business, basically, and it was essentially the monopoly company for a very long time. So during 1934, newspaper reporters wanted to write stories about, they wanted to interview the guy who invented Monopoly, right? Because it was this phenomenon, like wildfire all over the country. So they call up Parker Brothers and they say, we want to interview the inventor of Monopoly. Parker Brothers says, all right, you know, we'll give you the guy, and here's the official story of how Monopoly was invented. And this is the inventor, Charles Darrow. And Charles Darrow, there's a picture of him playing Monopoly. He went and talked to all the newspaper reporters, and this is the story he told. He said, well, you know, he was unemployed, the Depression, so 20% of 25% of Americans were unemployed, so not so unusual. And he's spending his unemployed time reading a novel. And the novel he's reading is about a high school kid. This high school boy is taking classes at a college preparatory school, but he fails out of the college preparatory school for whatever reasons, and his backup option is what's called a commercial school. In those days, a commercial school would prepare you for a job as a clerk or an accountant of sorts in a business. So you're learning how to balance books, you're learning some basic accounting. One of the things they did in this school, in the novel, was that all the boys would get cardboard stock certificates. And then they would get paper money, and they were supposed to buy and sell the stocks, the fake stocks, right? As a way of practicing negotiation and trading and learning something about the stock market. So Charles Darrow was reading this novel, and he's reading this part about the stock certificates and paper money, and he says, aha, this could make a good board game, paper money. So he goes down in his basement, and he starts cutting up paper, and he gets his colored pencils and paint. He makes the board game Monopoly. Then he takes it to Parker Brothers and gets the patent and sells it to Parker Brothers, and the rest is history. But it sounds good, but there's just one problem with the story. It's a complete lie. Charles Darrow did not invent Monopoly. It fits really well with this linear model of creativity that I showed you, the idea, the selection, the execution, the brilliant genius inventor having a flash of insight down in the basement, but it's a complete lie. That's not the way Monopoly was invented. The real way Monopoly was invented is a story of this kind of distributed, collaborative system invention. So I'm going to tell you briefly the story, and there's a lot that's been published about this. Does anyone know the story already, by the way? Monopoly's an interesting intellectual property story for those IP-oriented lawyers. So it goes back to, this is a pretty famous economist, but no one's heard of him anymore. His name's Henry Lloyd George. Anyone heard of Henry Lloyd George? Sometimes I get a few hands. Henry Lloyd George, advocate. But this was a photo from 1879 when he published his best-selling book. His best-selling book was called Progress and Poverty. It still remains the best-selling economics textbook ever. Progress and Poverty, translated into almost every language. It advocated George's philosophy of governing and taxation, which became known as the single tax philosophy. And the single tax is more complex, but basically the idea was that there would be only one tax, and the tax would be on land. And you would be taxed in proportion to the amount of land you own. And by the way, no one pays rent, so everyone gets to live rent-free. And there was sort of elements of the socialist utopia in the single tax philosophy. But it became known as single tax because of the single tax on land. You can probably imagine there were a lot of powerful people that did not like this idea of having all their land taxed and having all their tenants live rent-free. So So it never went anywhere. I mean, Henry Lloyd George ran for office a couple of times in New York State. He died young of illness before he was ever able to get elected. And his ideas never got implemented anywhere. There's some small towns in Delaware that sort of were single tax towns, but there was one group of people that really bought into the single tax philosophy, and they were the American Quakers. And the Quaker community were big advocates of the single tax philosophy. They were realizing, though, that it wasn't going anywhere. So there was a Virginia Quaker named Lizzie Maggie. Lizzie Maggie said, you know, I got to do something to help convince people that the single tax philosophy is the right way. And she decided to, education was the solution. If we just educate everyone about why single tax is better, then people will come along, right? People will come on board. So her way of educating people was to invent a board game. And this is from her patent in 1904 for what was called the landlord's game. And you can tell where I'm going already because of the shape of the board. But it's very different from the Monopoly the Parker Brothers movies. But it has some similar features. She actually patented this, and here it is, and took it to Parker Brothers, and Parker Brothers said, no, we're not interested. It's a horrible idea. But she wasn't all about the money either. She wanted single tax philosophy to take over the world. So she started giving it away. And her Quaker friends loved it. Well, how does it teach you the virtues of single tax? Well, she actually patented it with two sets of rules. In one set of rules, you play with the evil capitalist system, where at the end of the game, one person gets all the money and everyone else is starving, right? And you realize how horrible that is. And then you play with the single tax set of rules, where everyone gets rich together and lives happily ever after. So when you play it both ways, then you learn the single tax is better, right? So that was their vision. So she starts sharing the game with her Quaker friends, and they loved it too. But you can't buy it, right? So everyone had to make their own version of the game. So people would get out these sheets of canvas or linen, oilcloth. They would draw on it with crayons, right? They make their own copies of the board. And it started to propagate all up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States and even into the Midwest. So I've got some pictures. A lot of these game copies are still in existence and they're valuable collector's items now. This is from 1910 in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So it's 6 years after she invented it. And by this time, a custom had emerged where when you are making a copy of Monopoly or the landlord's game, you change all the place names. You change all the space names to be names of locations in your own city. So this board has all street names from Allentown, Pennsylvania. So in that custom stayed with the game as it moved around the country. Here's a copy of the board from outside of Philadelphia. It's a county called Bucks County. And the reason why I've got this one is because in the man's hand, I like this picture, because you can see this is what they use for playing pieces. Because you don't have, you're not buying any pieces, right? So you just use common household objects. So people would use buttons and thimbles. You know, again, you can see that represented in the game that got patented by Parker Brothers, right? And then there's a beautiful copy of the game here from 1928. This is by an economics professor at Columbia University. And in fact, a lot of economics professors use the landlord's game in their classes. By sometime in the 1920s, this version of the game had emerged where if you bought three properties of the same color, then you had a monopoly and you could charge more money. That was not in the original 1904 patent. And after that emerged, a couple years after that, people started calling it monopoly. And by 1928 here, it was known as monopoly. And this guy, Professor Stryker, I think is his name, I don't even think he's a Quaker, just an economist who used the game with his students. And all these spaces are cities outside of New York City or street names inside of New York City. So we have this custom, and you know, by this point, we get up to 1934, and Charles Darrow, right? Remember Charles Darrow, he's visiting some Quaker friends of his who are in Atlantic City. And so he's got the Quaker friends in Atlantic City, and they have a version of Monopoly that has all the street names from Atlantic City, just like the game always does. And he really liked what he played. He said, can you make a copy of the rules for me? And they innocently made a copy of the rules for him. At this point, the single tax version of the rules, I think that had fallen by the wayside. Even the Quakers were playing the evil capitalist version. So he takes the rules back to his home, Germantown, Pennsylvania, I think is where he lived at the time. And he basically ripped it off, right? He copied it, lock, stock, and barrel, from the Atlantic City version of the game. There, the particular board game he was playing was made by his Quaker friends. They misspelled some of the street names. The version that you buy from Parker Bros has the same misspellings in it, right? So it's a complete ripoff from the Atlantic City Quaker version. So he went and fraudulently got it back. And then he went to Parker Brothers and sold it to Parker Bros. Parker Bros didn't know it was not really a valid patent. And then the game takes off and it's a huge success. So, and by the way, for intellectual property lawyers out there, Parker Brothers learned pretty quickly in 1934 that patent was not valid and that the game actually had been around for 30 years. And they went around and started buying up. They bought up, Lizzie McGee was still alive. They bought her out for $5,000, I think. And they bought out a couple other people who had versions of the game. So they made it right, I guess, in some people's sense. But the story that you hear, or the story that all these newspaper reporters got, I think the reason why people fell for the story is because it fits really well with the myths, the misconceptions we have about how creativity and innovation work. It's that linear model, right? A genius person coming up with a big flash of insight, and that's the source of creativity. You know, it fits well with product creativity. It fits really well with the psychologist's way of thinking about how the world works. You can study the mental processes. But in reality, innovations emerge over long periods of time. It's never about one moment of creativity, but it's many moments of creativity. And there's a myth we have that creativity is the sort of straight path to success. And after the fact, everything seems like it was foreordained, right? But when you look at the history of innovation, there are always lots of dead ends. And the dead ends, you sort of forget about historically. But think about Monopoly, where every city had its own version. Some versions had the rule where you could buy community properties and charge more money, other versions did not. Think of all the versions of the rules that are lost to history, right? So this is the nature of creativity, lots of dead ends. And again, you ought to be thinking about the improvisational performance parallels here, right? Because an improvisational performance does not emerge fully formed in the mind of any one musician, right? It emerges over the night's performance. In any sort of improvisational theater or jazz, there are dead ends. Musicians throw out ideas, they don't get picked up, right? All this is true of improvisation as well. And then we have this myth of the lone genius being responsible for creativity, when in fact, it's always about small ideas for many different people. Again, the analogy with improvisation is plain. That it's not about the leader of the ensemble coming up with all the ideas, or even one idea, but all the musicians are having ideas all the time, laying them out on the table. So there's lots of small ideas. So this is the way, not only that improvisation works, but I claim it's the way that all innovation works. So that's why my talk's titled Social Innovation. So now when I step back into improvised performance, and give you an example from my research on improvisational theater to demonstrate some other characteristics of improvisation that potentially have some lessons for improvisation or innovation in the social sphere. I'm going to give you an example of a contrast between two groups that I studied in Chicago. And one of the groups is called Jazz Freddy. And these are both long-form performances. Jazz Freddy in 1993, they went for almost an hour up on stage, starting without knowing anything, right? And they actually took an intermission in the middle, so they had two acts. Just a phenomenal group, legendary in Chicago. 10 actors performing up on stage. I'm gonna show you a brief clip so you get a sense of how this works. And then I studied a group called The Family, which does a genre of improvisation they invented that they called the movie. And the movie was almost 50 minutes. So again, these are very long performances. They did not take an intermission between, and they only had five actors. So these groups did very similar things. The community of Chicago improv actors had been experimenting with this sort of genre of long-form improvisation and had come up with a couple of similarities and parallels, right? One of them was, if you're going to go on for 60 minutes, You can't just pick one plot line and go through linearly. That doesn't work so well. I mean, if you're watching a 1 hour televised drama or you're watching a sitcom, sitcoms have 3 or 4 different plot lines, right, weaving together. So they actually try to do this. Both of these groups would create multiple plot lines in parallel that would remain independent, and then they would try to weave them together at the end. So if any of you remember this show called Seinfeld, where Seinfeld had the 4 main characters, and in many of the Seinfeld episodes, there would be a plot for each of the characters, and they would be basically independent. And then at the end, by the end, they would sort of wrap them up. So this is, I don't know if I want to say the inspiration comes from television, but that's kind of what they're trying to do. And what's different from television, the actors can play a different character in each plot. So if you're in the first plot, you can come out and be the father or whatever. If you're in a different plot, you might be a police officer in a completely different city. So each actor plays a different character in each plot, which adds a lot of potential confusion, right? But a lot of potential interesting possibilities. And the way that you get from one plot to another, how do you do that? Well, they would do a scene edit. If you're on television, you do a camera edit, right? So they would do a scene edit and would basically reproduce a camera edit in the studio. I call a scene edit, but basically there are different ways to accomplish a scene edit. And that's what I focused on, in fact, was that these two groups, in spite of these similarities, they had very different ways of doing the scene edits. The key contrast is that in Jazz Freddy, the scene edits were always in frame. The term we use in conversation analysis to mean that you're staying in character, you're staying within the scene when you do your scene edit. So you stay within the frame, the dramatic frame that you created. Whereas in the movie, they allow these out-of-frame edits that I call director talk. So imagine, you know, you're sitting down and the actors are all improvising the scene, and then one of the actors decides we need to edit to another scene. That actor would stand up, step away, and say, now we're going to cut to the bar where the man and the woman are flirting. And then the man and the woman actors run out on stage and the other actors walk off. So that would be a very much an out-of-frame, out-of-character edit. In Jazz Freddy, that was not allowed. Right, everyone stays in character, they maintain the fourth wall, right, the dramatic illusion. And the interesting thing I found about this contrast is that it resulted in very different processes of improvisation in unpredictable ways that the performers themselves were not aware of. Different outcomes resulted as an indirect, unintended effect of this contrast. So I'll get to that in a minute, but first I want to give you the example. So this is Jazz Freddy. I'm going to show you just under 5 minutes.
Hi, welcome to Jazz Freddy. This is a fully improvised show.
Indeed it is, and we will have 2 acts tonight and an intermission in between. So you can intermission if you'd like.
Yes, and what we need now is an event.
You'll have it. Okay, and I need a suggestion too, and that would be of a location, a specific location.
A convent.
A convent. So we've got as our location a convent.
And our event, which is the Olympics.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Whenever possible.
God, that's good.
know you would say the same thing if Ryan wasn't speaking for you. I brought you those spots.
He's in your corner too.
I think Ray's a little more nervous about it than I am.
He's the most nervous of all of us. Ray's the most nervous. There. It's out.
No, no, you said not. I made him nervous. I'm surprised you're all that way.
Feel my palms. Feel his sweat. Huh? You drain them off in buckets. See? You should feel Ray's. They're like a sponge.
No big deal. I'm studying them. I'm all my passes.
We're in your corner.
Anyway, I have a great team here.
That's what I'm saying.
I got it. Some shut eye.
That's what we think. If there's anything you need, some shut eye, some sleep. Ray hasn't been able to sleep for 3 days because you haven't been sleeping.
Well, that's part of being on my team, you know.
We understand.
I sneeze and you get the flu.
Right. I have the sniffles right now.
Bad ways. Right ways. Let's do it.
All right.
No, no.
We can't go to sleep yet. We've got to study harder. We're going to make the grade.
Subtle example of a scene edit and the way they accomplish it because they can't step out of character. You can see the woman, she walks out in front of the action. And if you walk out and enter the stage in front of the action, then the other actors know you're accomplishing an edit. But you saw earlier an actor who walked in behind the action. I brought you those files, right? That's not a scene edit. So this is a customary practice that has emerged in the community that not only this group invented, but many other ensembles do long form, use these same practices. But you're looking at this and you don't have any idea what's going on, right? You're not even probably sure why the audience is laughing, because it doesn't. They're not making jokes, right? They're not trying to be funny. So I want you to take that sensation you have of having no idea what these actors are doing and realize that the actors are in the same place you are. The actors have no more idea of what they're doing than you. And they embrace that, right? They welcome that. They say, this is what we want. We want to not know. We want to let it happen, right? To unfold from what we're going to do. And they have to perform for 60 minutes, right? If they told you everything they were going to do in the first 5 minutes, well, they wouldn't have anything left to do for the remaining 15 minutes. So it is kind of odd to watch just 5 minutes, I realize. I have no idea what's going on, but it's instructive to realize the actors also have no clue what's going on. So let me show you the difference with the movie where they do this out-of-character talk. Then I'll move on and tell you why this is interesting and the kinds of different innovation that results. This is all directed talk.
A large wooden gate, square, huge, big timbers, big cross piece of iron with huge squared spikes. Holding the piece of iron to the crossbar. Pan over this side, there's a massive chain, huge, the links are this big around, holding this thing, pans down to the ground. And as we get closer to the ground, we can see that there's a body of water here. There are daisies floating in the water. And it's down to the ground, attached to a post that's as big as an elephant's leg, chained to it. Pull back with a gigantic drawbridge.
Pull farther back to reveal on the pathway from the body of water a man walks by. He wears a simple plain cotton white shirt, tannish pants with brown work boots. He has a simple but not unintelligent look on his face. Sort of man who accepts life as it comes at him. He looks at the gate, ponders it, stands there in reflection.
Pull into this man's eyes, and we do a time dash back. When we pull back from his eyes, it's the same man, except he's now dressed in a potato sack, whatever they wore,
and he's got on leggings and leather boots
and they're only up to here, and they kind of come out like that. He's wearing this burlap over thing is cut like the top of a rook on the chessboard.
The camera pulls back from him, and we see behind him several hundred of peasants with bonfires burning, and everyone is very dirty. There are pigs running around loose, and chickens, and children playing with clumps of mud. There's sort of a fog in the background. As we behind the fog are some deep, deep woods. We see the man, his small figure, slightly out of focus, with this massive scene going on behind him. We rack focus back to the man.
Okay, well that's enough, but this is just to get you a sense of what director talk is, right? They're all out of character, in fact, in this first 5 minutes. It goes about 5 minutes before any character actually starts speaking in character. And then they enact scenes in character, but the edits, the scene edits, continue to be in this form of director talk. So why is this interesting? It's interesting because it results in the emergence of different forms of innovation. Just because of these differences in interactional strategy. And the message is that the way you interact with each other and the types of strategies you use actually has an impact on what gets generated. So I'll talk about a couple of key contrasts that I call emergent patterns. And I call them emergent because they're unintended. And they happen collaboratively as a result of the interaction of the actors. And it's sort of a whole phenomenon, a whole property of the entire group. Not associated with any one individual. No individual intends this, no individual has the insight, no individual has the idea. In fact, the performers aren't even aware that they're doing it, right? Until I pointed out to them afterwards. So the movie performances, the key difference is that, one of the key differences, had more intricate plots. So they're both creating multiple plots that they want to weave together, right? So in the movie group, Jazz Freddy only created two plots. The movie created four. The movie is creating more plots, and they're merging the plots more effectively. Think if you create more plots, it's going to be harder to merge them. If you have only two, it should be easier to merge two. So not only is the movie creating more plots, four different plot lines, but they're merging them more effectively. And I counted up just some very basic statistics. The number of scenes which were that merged plots, that had two or more plots in them, the movie had 27% of their second half of the performance did that. Neither group merged any plots in the first half. And Jazz Freddy, only 9%. Jazz Freddy, not very effective, right, at merging their plots together in the second half. But Jazz Freddy wasn't, oh, yeah, what's that?
Is that just, it's all on the same statistics.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So this contrast is for just the two performances that I showed you. I also have videotapes of many other performances of both groups, and they are similar, right? But it's rather time-consuming to transcribe and count up, so it's hard to do this level of detail on more than one contrast. But yeah, this plays out throughout all the performances of the groups. But Jazz Freddy wasn't just a bad group. In fact, I prefer Jazz Freddy. So what were they doing instead of creating plots and merging plots? They were creating characters and relationships. Jazz Freddy had much more developed characters than the movie. 17 of the movie's 29 characters only appeared in one scene. If you're appearing in one scene, you're not going to be developing, right? The scenes are only 2 minutes long. In essence, all the movie characters were very flat characters. Characters in service of the plot. Whereas Jazz Freddy actually had characters that had some personalities, and quirks. They came back. They actually had relationships. And Jazz Freddy's relationships were more complex and more developed. So I counted up, I came up with a way of identifying how developed a relationship was, if it was complementary. That meant that it went on for more than one scene, developed. So Jazz Freddy, actually 11 of the relationships were pretty serious relationships, meaning that they developed over time, over the course of the performance. In the movie, only one of the relationships between the characters occurred in more than one scene. So basically there's no emphasis whatsoever on relationships and the development of relationships. So that's a pretty dramatic contrast. And the reason why it's happening is not because the ensembles intended it, right? They didn't get together in Jazz Freddy and say, we really believe that characters and relationships are what's critical in drama. And we are going to improvise tonight really well-developed characters and relationships. No, they did not intend that. They, in fact, they aren't even aware that they're doing it, right? It's an unintended effect of the interactional strategies that they use for the scenes. And I know the actors aren't aware of them because I interviewed the actors and I've watched a lot of these different performances. But another interesting point is that once these dramatic frames have emerged, they also constrain the actors, but also enable the actors to do different kinds of things. So for example, in Jazz Freddy, once you have some relationships identified and developed between the characters, you can actually use the relationships to accomplish the scene edit effectively. So let's say you're a husband and wife. By the way, the Jazz Freddy characters were much more likely to have names. In the movie, the characters didn't even have names. So Jazz Freddy, you're an actor and your name is Mark, let's say, in the scene. Mark is, let's say, sitting off the side of the stage and not in the current scene, and you want to accomplish a scene edit, and let's say you're Mark's wife, Mary. So you walk off and say, Mark, I can't believe you left the dirty dishes in the sink again. Now Mark knows he's supposed to come on stage and be in the scene, right, and be your husband. So he knows who, everyone knows who's supposed to be on stage. Everyone knows which plot you're in. Right, so the actors can use this character and relationship information to help them accomplish the scene edit. So that's an enabling feature of the emergent dramatic frame. So again, I leave you with that as an example. I think the key message is that what happens in improvisational innovation, it's unpredictable. When it's collaborative and improvisational, it's unpredictable and it emerges from the actions of everyone working together in a way that no one can predict and no one intends. And again, it contradicts that linear model of innovation where one person has the big flash of insight and everyone else just executes the idea. That's not what's going on in improvisation. It's collective, and you can't find the answer by looking in the heads of any of the performers, right? Because the answer is in the space between the performers. So I'm going to close with one more story about what I call a collaborative web. And I've already given you one example, the community of Quakers and economics professors that resulted in Monopoly. I think of that as a collaborative web. It's like what today we might call it an open source community, right? But I think these webs have existed forever. It's not just about the internet. The internet helps these collaborative webs to form, and they can be spread out over space more easily than in the past. But it's still the same social process. It's always been around. And I got another old example from pre-internet to support that claim. And this photo, a lot of you will recognize, is probably the most famous photo of innovation ever. This is the very first, according to the Wright brothers anyway, the very first powered flight of an aircraft operated by a human operator. So this is down in North Carolina on the beach, Kitty Hawk, Hill Devil Hills. And you know, here's a Orville standing off the wing saying, you can tell him he's flying, like, holy shit, it's flying. And there's Wilbur Wright lying prone on the lower wing, flying a craft. They got some beefy local lifeguards to help them move the plane out of the hangar. He was standing next to the camera on a tripod. And they said, you know, if the thing gets off the ground, pull the string, take a picture. So actually, a lot of their pictures, the plane is half out of the frame. So this one just came out great. First flight, got very lucky with the camera and the lifeguard. So you hear the story of innovation, invention. You always hear who invented the telegraph, right? Who invented the telephone? And it's always a story of one person, or in this case, it's two brothers, right? Well, what I find when I look at the history of invention is that those stories are almost always false. We have this myth, again, of the lone inventor coming up with a flash of insight and then realizing the genius of their invention. And you scratch beneath the surface historically and you find that's never what happened. In fact, there's always webs of collaboration. There are always lots of other people. It's just like Monopoly. There are multiple dead ends, right? There are unintended and unpredictable paths. After the fact, it looks like it was obvious what should have been done. But at the time, no one's sure, right? Well, and first of all, the Wright brothers were very much a collaborative team. There's two of them. You can see here's an image from one of their journals. They talk constantly about their conversations. They write about their conversations in the journals. The way they came up with the key idea that allowed them to have successfully controlled flight, it occurred in a conversation. Let me give you back to the image. the key insight for the Wright brothers, they were steering the craft laterally by twisting, warping the wings. And if they warped the wings by pulling on these wires, the wings were just made of light balsa wood, so the whole wings would twist. And that would make the plane steer. But when they did that, the plane would actually then start turning and it would dive and crash. So they said, you know, what are we gonna do about this? Maybe we'll put, you know, a vertical tail at the end and maybe that'll help. So they put the vertical tail and the plane still crashes, you know, one out of 50 times. I mean, they're flying constantly, 50 times a day. So once a day they crash, well, those odds aren't pretty good, you know, because any time we crash, we could die. So we need to fix this. So they have this conversation. Maybe Wilbur says, maybe we can take this fixed vertical tail. What probably has to happen is we have to go move it like this. And it probably has to move in concert with the wings warping to keep us from doing this crash. But how are we going to, maybe we could put another cable and make them turning. And Orville had the follow-on idea in the same conversation. Well, that's too many cables for the operator, but maybe we could attach that cable to the control cable that warps the wings. So when you start warping the wings, the tail automatically turns. And actually, that's what they did, and it ended up working, and they never had that crash again. So that's an example of the power of a conversation to result in collaboration. But the real point I have here is it wasn't just about the Wright brothers. I mean, the Wright brothers went out and got a patent on flight. But really, their patent wasn't for flight. They got a patent very specifically on their control mechanism of warping the wing. So the one unique thing in their patent was wing warping. And they actually were successful at enforcing that patent up until World War I started. So no one else, the patent was very broadly interpreted to mean any sort of portion of the wing moving in any sort of direction. So by 1907, other aviators had come up with a better idea, which is instead of warping the whole wing, we'll just move a surface at the back of the wing. That's what we do today, it's called an aileron. So the Wright brothers said, we went out and got a patent on that. It was an aviator named Glenn Curtis, funded by Alexander Graham Bell. So the court said, no, that's covered by the Wright brothers patent, you can't do that, unless you pay them a royalty. The Wright brothers are charging like $1,000 per airplane, and that was too much. No one could make any money doing that. So they really blocked up the US, United States aviation industry. But they had a lot of trouble enforcing these patents in Europe. So what happened was incredible innovation in Europe, France, Germany, and England in the aviation industry, and nothing happening in the United States. So here's, so before I go there, I want to say, here's a picture. Looks a whole lot like the Wright brothers plane, but that's not one of the Wright brothers. That is a famous French aviator, his name's Octave Chanute. And this is from 1896. The Wright brothers had their first successful flight in 1903. They didn't even start thinking about flying until 1900. And when they started thinking about it, they called up Octave Chanute, the famous aviator. He was a sharing kind of friendly guy. In fact, the aviation community at this time was, they were like hobbyists. They weren't possessive. They were all sharing the information. We're all in this together. It was almost like a scientific academic community, right? So the Wright brothers got information from all over the world. People would write them stuff. That was a collaborative web. They shared with these people. Octave Chanute, in fact, got really angry at the Wright brothers' legal maneuvers and later claimed they weren't the first people to have the idea of warping the wings. That idea had been around already. They shouldn't have got that patent anyway. So here's what I call it. It's like a picture of the collaborative web, right? So the collaborative web is these graphs. The blue line, this is on the left axis, the number of feet that your flight lasts, and it's kind of a logarithmic graph. So 400 feet is the blue line, 400 feet flight, all the way back to 1890. So what's going on is that these are gliders, they're not motorized, sometimes they don't have people in them. But, you know, we figured out how to fly 400 feet back in 1890. The Wright brothers come along in 1900, and they have a pretty key idea. They put it all together in a certain way, and they jump out of the pack, right? But my point is that there already was a pack, right? There's already a collaborative web there that they could build on. And then what happened is that they blocked innovation by enforcing their patents. So these red dots on the right are all these innovators in Europe who moved forward while the Wright brothers were blocking everyone in the United States. And by 1910, the rest of the collaborative web had surpassed the Wright brothers, right? And now we're up to, look at the top, those red dots, that's over 200 miles. Like, so things moved very rapidly, and the Wright brothers still were doing pretty well, but the there's two points here, and one is that they didn't work alone. They worked as part of a community, a collaborative lab, which again was like an open source community just before the term of on the left, right? And then after they came up with these ideas, then we have this collaborative web that was able to move beyond. The collaborative web is more powerful than any one individual. So the message there, I guess, for all these examples is that creativity is not linear. You want to apply it to the social sphere, I'd say to social policy. We had these meetings yesterday about how improvisation applies to social policy. I think a lot about social entrepreneurship, social innovation, but innovation in general. I think the key things to keep in mind is that it's never about one person having a brilliant idea. It's always about a group of people working together. And then what you really need is to form these collaborative webs, which work in an improvisational fashion. And what happens when you do that is you have really unexpected, unpredictable things that emerge from the genius of the group, as it were. And sometimes the group is stupid, and what emerges is not so great. So you need to be smart about it, right? You need to know how to create an effective collaborative web. You need to know how to harvest the good ideas when they come out and decide which ideas are not so good and not move forward with those. But I think that also has to be a collective decision. It's not that there should be one person deciding. So I guess my closing message is that we'll all be more innovative if we participate in these collaborative webs and share more openly and not be so possessive and egocentric about our ideas or our creativity, but to realize that creativity is always a collaboration and it's always a form of improvisation writ large in the social world. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. That really gets us started. We probably have time for one or two quick questions if anybody has them. Right up front.
Yeah, well, I'm an academic, so I don't know if that'd be a quick question. There you go. Thanks for the talk. I really appreciate it. I guess the lingering question for me, it has to do with the way you opened the talk, speaking about the product-based creativity versus this other kind of creativity that involves improvisation, which you implicitly suggested that maybe the point of that is not to get a product. Is that, am I reading that correctly?
Right, the point of improvisation is not to generate a product.
Not necessarily to generate a product.
Although a product might be generated, yeah.
Right, exactly. Okay, so what I'm wondering though is that from the examples that you showed, especially the Monopoly and the Flight examples, I'm wondering though, what would stop some smart entrepreneur from saying, this is great, Keith Sawyer's ideas are wonderful, I'm gonna get a bunch of people together, have them think up all the stuff, and then I'm gonna take credit for it and make a lot of money. So I'm using the creativity model, using improvisation, but I'm trying to get a product out of that innovation and claim credit for it.
Well, exactly. I give quite a few talks to business executives who are interested in exactly that.
Right.
How can I make my organization collaboratively effective at generating innovation so that our stockholders will make more money? I think about stealing the ideas of, the guy who stole Monopoly, right?
Right.
So it's not about that, but sometimes it is kind of an artificial distinction between the product creativity and the process or improvisational creativity. Because the examples I gave you did result in a product, even though there was
right.
improvisation, right? So you end up with Monopoly. You end up with the airplane. And if you're in a business setting, you create a collaborative process, and you want to end up with the product that you're going to sell. So your intention is ultimately to have a product, but you realize if you listen to people like me and lots of other management scholars, you realize that this is how innovation most effectively happens, is through this collaborative improvisational process. So it's kind of a paradox, right? While my employees are engaged in it, they don't know where it's going and they don't know what the product is going to be or if there even will be a successful product. But at the same time, I know from the research that's the way it has to happen. So I don't have any choice. Right, and if you're lucky, eventually a good product emerges. And a lot of times, a lot of failed products stay on the shelf.
I guess I'm still sort of concerned, though, about who gets compensated and how for these products or innovations, because it seems like in both of the flight and the Monopoly example, you have a lot of people doing all this great creative work, but only a few people are actually reaping the rewards of that. Now, it's, I guess, right, open right. to say, well, whether the Quakers wanted rewards or whatever, you know, okay, right. maybe that's a
yeah, so there's,
but jazz musicians, for example, I think want some compensation for their creativity.
Right. No, it's a great question, right? Right? It's a complex, there's no simple answer. I'd say there's two areas that are relevant, and one is intellectual property law. Right, is who gets the property right to the idea, and I have a different talk, which I do for IP, but yeah, I think the IP regime in the United States is completely misaligned with the way innovation works. And the other set of questions or answers is incentives. So if you are an employee, what's the best way to structure incentives so that my people will share and collaborate in this manner, and yet not feel like someone's stealing their ideas and getting all the money and they're not getting it. So yes, if you're in a company and you feel like that, then collaboration's not gonna happen, right? So the management of the company cannot be thinking, I'm just gonna steal everyone's ideas. It's, you're like killing the goose that lays the golden eggs.
Right.
But I guess
okay. I'm gonna draw a line under that. In part because in the next session at 10:30, in the intellectual property session, Giuseppe Mazziotti is here, who owns Improvised Music, Gustavo Bartogil, Owners Without Authors, Computer Generated Works and Copyright Law, etc. So these are the kinds of discussions that are going to continue over the next couple of days. We have 10 minutes for a break. Please eat the food, but please decide which of the two parallel sessions you're going to go to. In this room, Law and Improvisation, we'll be looking at film, television, and Horkheimer and Adorno. And downstairs, intellectual property and improvisation, including Professor Mazziotti and Gustavo Gil and Alvaro Moreno and Patrick Dunn. Thank you, Keith. The book is Group Genius, and the Wright brothers and Monopoly examples are to discuss there.
And I just found out recently that I got a postdoc fellowship, so I'm going to be here for next year. Yeah. What about you? How are you doing? Are you here at the Gill?
No, I'm going to try to actually
get to the Oh, fabulous. I'm going to be at Mayo. Yeah. Oh, where are you going? Oh, that's fabulous. Are you in that jazz studies program, or is that for management?
What are your teaching areas this year?
Hey, did you know about the Quaker Monopoly? Is that part of the local law?
Yeah, okay.
I thought I'd learn as a Quaker, yeah.
Okay. Do you use it in class?
No.
Okay. That's a good story.
It is, yeah.
I was looking, I could see the place. And okay, they had the railways, they had the luxury side.
It had beautiful. I think one was also the amateur colors, too.
Okay.
How's it for you?
Hi.
Good to see you. Good to see you.
No problem. That's why we brought a laptop.
Wilson, we need to use this laptop for projecting the
Thank you.